This is Audible.
Summer Night by Jim Butcher. This production is brought to you by Buzzy Multimedia Audiobooks and is read to you by James Marsters.
Chapter 1. It rained toads the day the White Council came to town. I got out of the Blue Beetle, my beat-up old Volkswagen Bug, and squinted against the midsummer sunlight. Lake Meadow Park lies a bit south of Chicago's Loop, a long sprint from Lake Michigan's shores. Even in heat like we'd had lately, the park would normally be crowded with people. Today it was deserted, but for an old lady with a shopping cart and a long coat tottering around the park. It wasn't yet noon, and my sweats and t-shirt were too hot for the weather. I squinted around the park for a moment, took a couple of steps onto the grass, and got hit on the head by something damp and squishy. I flinched and slapped at my hair. Something small fell past my face and onto the ground at my feet. A toad. Not a big one, as toads go. It could easily have sat in the palm of my hand. It wobbled for a few moments upon hitting the ground, and then let out a bleary croak and started hopping drunkenly away. I looked around me and saw other toads on the ground, a lot of them. The sound of their croaking grew louder as I walked further into the park. Even as I watched, several more amphibians plopped out of the sky, as though the Almighty had dropped them down a laundry chute. Toads hopped around everywhere. They didn't carpet the ground, but you couldn't possibly miss them. Every moment or so, you could hear the thump of another one landing. Their croaking sounded vaguely like the speech chatter of a crowded room. "Weird, huh?" said an eager voice. I looked up to see a short young man with broad shoulders and a confident walk coming towards me. Billy the Werewolf wore sweatpants and a plain dark T-shirt. A year or two ago, the outfit would have concealed the 40 or 50 extra pounds he'd been carrying. Now they concealed all the muscle he'd traded it in for. He stuck out his hand, smiling. "What did I tell you, Harry?" "Billy," I responded. He crunched down hard as I shook his hand. Or maybe he was just that much stronger. "How's the werewolf biz?" "Getting interesting," he said. "We've run into a lot of odd things lately when we've been out patrolling. Like this." He gestured around the park. Another toad fell from the sky several feet away. "That's why we call the wizard." "Patrolling? Holy vigilantes, Batman. Any of the normals been here?" "No, except for some meteorological guys from the university. They said they're having tornadoes in Louisiana or something, that the storms must have thrown the toads here." I snorted. "You'd think its magic would be easier to swallow than that." Billy grinned. "Don't worry. I'm sure someone will come along and declare it a hoax before long." "Uh-huh." I turned back to the Beetle and popped the hood to rummage around the forward storage compartment. I came out with a nylon backpack and dragged a couple of small cloth sacks out of it. I threw one to Billy. "Grab a couple of toads and pitch them in here for me." He caught the bag and frowned. "Why?" "So I can make sure they're real." Billy lifted his eyebrows. "You think they're not?" I squinted at him. "Look, Billy, just do it. I haven't slept. I can't remember the last time I had a hot meal, and I got a lot to do before tonight." "But why wouldn't they be real? They look real." I blew out a breath and tried to keep my temper. It had been short lately. "They could look real and feel real, but it's possible they're just constructs, made out of the material of the never-never and animated by magic. I hope they are." "Why?" "Because all that would mean is that some fairy got bored and played a trick. They do that sometimes." "Okay, but if they're real?" "If they're real, it means something is out of whack." "What kind of out of whack?" "The serious kind. Holes in the fabric of reality." "And that would be bad?" I eyed him. "Yeah, Billy, that would be bad. It would mean something big is going down." "But what if..." My temper flared. "I don't have time or inclination to teach class today. Shut the hell up." He lifted a hand in a pacifying gesture. "Okay, man, whatever." He fell into step beside me and started picking up toads as we walked across the park. So, it's good to see you, Harry. Me and the gang were wondering if you wanted to come by this weekend, do some socializing." I scooped up a toad of my own and eyed him dubiously. "Doing what?" He grinned at me. "Playing Arkanos, man. The campaign's getting really fun." "Role-playing games." I made a monosyllabic sound. The old lady with the shopping cart wandered past us, the wheels of the cart squeaking and wobbling. "Seriously, it's great," he insisted. We're storming the fortress of Lord Malachio, except we have to do it in disguise, in the dead of night, so that the Council of Truth won't know who the vigilantes who brought them down here were. There's spells and demons and dragons and everything. Interested?
Sounds too much like work.
Billy let out a snort.
Harry, look, I know this whole vampire war thing has you jumpy and grouchy, but you've been lurking in your basement way too much lately.
What vampire war? Billy rolled his eyes.
Word gets around, Harry. I know that the Red Court of the Vampires declared war on the wizards after you burned down Bianca's place last fall. I know that they tried to kill you a couple of times since then. I even know that the Wizards' White Council is coming to town sometime soon to figure out what to do.
I glowered at him. What White Council? He sighed.
It's not a good time for you to be turning into a hermit, Harry. I mean, look at you. When was the last time you shaved? Had a shower, a haircut, go out to do your laundry.
I lifted a hand and scratched at the wiry growth of beard at my face.
I've been out plenty of times.
Billy staggered. Billy snagged another toad.
Like when? I went to that football game with you and the Alphas.
He snorted.
Yeah, in January, Dresden. It's June.
Billy glanced up at my face and frowned.
People are worried about you. I mean, I know you've been working on some project or something, but this whole unwashed, wild man look just isn't you.
I stopped and grabbed a toad.
I don't know what you're talking about. I know better than you think, he said. It's about Susan, right? Something happened to her last fall. Something you're trying to undo. Maybe something the vampires did. That's why she left town.
I closed my eyes and tried not to crush the toad in my hand. Drop the subject. Billy planted his feet and thrust his chin out at me.
No, Harry. Damn it, you vanish from the face of the earth. You hardly show up at your office, won't answer your phone, don't often answer your door. We're your friends, and we're worried about you.
I'm fine, I said. You're a lousy liar. Word is that the Reds are bringing more muscle into town, that they're offering their groupies full vampirehood if one of them brings you down.
Hell's bells, I muttered. My head started to ache. It isn't a good time for you to be outside by yourself, even during daylight.
I don't need a babysitter, Billy.
Harry, I know you better than most. I know you can do stuff that other people can't, but that doesn't make you Superman. Everybody needs help sometimes.
Not me, not now. I stuffed the toad into my sack and picked up another. I don't have time for it.
Oh, that reminds me.
Billy drew a folded piece of paper out of the pocket of his sweats and read it.
You've got an appointment with the client at 3.
I blinked at him.
What? I dropped by your office and checked your messages. Miss Somerset was trying to reach you, so I called her and set up an appointment for you.
I felt my temper rising again. You did what? His expression turned annoyed.
I checked your mail, too. The landlord for the office dropped off your eviction notice. If you don't have him paid off in a week, he's booting you out.
What the hell gives you the right to go poking around my office, Billy? Or calling my clients?
He took a step in front of me, glaring. I had to focus on his nose to avoid the risk of looking at his eyes.
Get off the high horse, Harry. I'm your freaking friend. You've been spending all your time hiding in your apartment. You should be happy I'm helping you save your business.
You're damn right it's my business, I spat. The shopping cart lady circled past in my peripheral vision, cartwheels squeaking as she walked behind me.
Mine, as in none of yours.
He thrust out his jaw.
Fine. How about you just crawl back to your cave until they evict you from that, too?
He spread his hands.
Good God, man. I don't need to be a wizard to see when someone's in a downward spiral. You're hurting. You need help.
I jabbed a finger into his chest.
No, Billy, I don't need more help. I don't need to be babysitting a bunch of kids who think that because they've learned one trick, they're ready to be the Lone Ranger with fangs and a tail. I don't need to be worrying about the vamps targeting the people around me when they can't get at me. I don't need to be second-guessing myself, wondering who else is going to get hurt because I dropped the ball.
I reached down and snatched up a toad, jerking a cloth bag from Billy's hands on the way back up.
I don't need you.
Naturally, the hit went down right then. It wasn't subtle, as attempted assassinations go. An engine roared, and a black, compact pickup truck jumped the curb into the park 50 yards away. It jounced and slew to one side, tires digging up furrows in the sun-baked grass. A pair of men clung to a roll bar in the back of the truck.
They were dressed all in black, complete with black sunglasses over black ski masks, and their guns matched, automatic weapons in the mini-Uzi tradition. "Get back!" I shouted. With my right hand, I grabbed at Billy and shoved him behind me. With my left, I shook out the bracelet on my wrist, hung with a row of tiny medieval-style shields. I lifted my left hand toward the truck and drew in my will, focusing it with the bracelet into a sudden, transparent, shimmering half-globe that spread out between me and the oncoming truck. The truck ground to a halt. The two gunmen didn't wait for it to settle. With all the fire discipline of an action movie extra, they pointed their guns more or less at me and emptied their clips in one roaring burst. Sparks flew from the shield in front of me, and the bullets whined and hissed in every direction as they ricocheted. My bracelet grew uncomfortably warm within a second or two, the energy of the shield taxing the focus to its limit. I tried to angle the shield to deflect the shots up into the air as much as possible. God only knew where all those bullets were going. I just hoped that they wouldn't bounce through a nearby car or some other passerby. The guns clicked empty. With jerky, unprofessional motions, both gunmen began to reload.
"Harry!"
Billy shouted.
"Not now!"
"But..." I lowered the shield and lifted my right hand, the side that projects energy. The silver ring I wore on my index finger had been enchanted to save back a little kinetic energy whenever my arm moved. I hadn't used the ring in months. It had a whale of a kick to it, one I hardly dared to use on the gunman. That much force could kill one of them, and that would be basically the same as letting them fill me full of bullets. It would just take a little longer to set in. The White Council did not take kindly to anyone violating the first law of magic, thou shalt not kill. I'd slipped it once on a technicality, but it wouldn't happen again. I gritted my teeth, focused my shot just to one side of the gunman, and triggered the ring. Raw force, unseen but tangible, lashed through the air and caught the first gunman with a glancing blow across his upper body. His automatic slammed against his chest, and the impact tore the sunglasses off his head and shredded bits of his clothes, even as it flung him back and out of the pickup to land somewhere on the ground on the other side. The second gunman got less of the blast. What did hit him struck against his shoulder and head. He held on to his gun but lost the sunglasses, and they took the ski mask with them, revealing him to be a plain-looking boy who couldn't have been old enough to vote. He blinked against the sudden light and then resumed his fumbling reload.
"Kids," I snarled, lifting my shield again. "They're sending kids after me. Hell's bells."
And then something made the hairs on the back of my neck try to lift me off the ground. As the kid with the gun started shooting again, I glanced back over my shoulder. The old lady with her shopping basket had stopped maybe 15 feet behind me. I saw now that she wasn't as old as I had thought. I caught a flicker of cool, dark eyes beneath age makeup. Her hands were young and smooth. From the depths of the shopping basket, she pulled out a sawed-off shotgun and swung it towards me. Bullets from the chattering automatic slammed against my shield, and it was all I could do to hold it in place. If I brought any magic to bear against the third attacker, I would lose my concentration and the shield with it. And, inexpert or not, the gunman on the truck was spraying around enough lead that sooner or later he wouldn't miss. On the other hand, if the disguised assassin got a chance to fire that shotgun from 5 yards away, no one would bother taking me to the hospital. I'd go straight to the morgue. Bullets hammered into my shield. I couldn't do anything but watch the third attacker bring the shotgun to bear. I was screwed, and probably Billy was, along with me. Billy moved. He had already gotten out of his T-shirt, and he had enough muscle to ripple. Flat, hard muscle, athlete's muscle. Not the carefully sculpted build of weightlifters. He dove forward toward the woman with the shotgun and stripped out of his sweatpants on the fly. He was naked beneath. I felt a surge of magic that Billy used then. Sharp, precise, focused. There was no sense of ritual in what he did, no slow gathering of power building to release. He blurred as he moved, and between one breath and the next, Billy the Naked was gone, and Billy the Wolf slammed into the assailant, a dark-furred beast the size of a Great Dane, fangs slashing at the hand that gripped the forward stock of the shotgun. The woman cried out, jerking her hand back, scarlet blood on her fingers, and swept the gun at Billy like a club. He twisted and caught the blow on his shoulders, a snarl exploding from him. He went after the woman's other hand, faster than I could easily see, and the shotgun tumbled to the ground. The woman screamed again and drew back her hand. She wasn't human. Her hands distended, lengthening, as did her shoulders and her jaw. Her nails became ugly, ragged talons, and she raked them down at Billy, striking him across the jaw, this time eliciting a pained yelp mixed with a snarl. He rolled to one side and came up on his feet, circling, in order to force the woman things back to me. The gunman in the truck clicked on empty again. I dropped the shield and hurled myself forward, diving to grip the shotgun. I came up with it and shouted, "Billy, move!" The wolf darted to one side, and the woman whipped around to face me, her distorted features furious, mouth drooling around tusk-like fangs. I pointed the gun at her belly and pulled the trigger. The gun roared and bucked, slamming hard against my shoulder, 10-gauge maybe, or slug rounds. The woman doubled over, letting out a shriek, and tumbled backward and to the ground. She wasn't down long. She almost bounced back to her feet. Scarlet splashed all over her rag of a dress, her face wholly inhuman now. She sprinted past me to the truck and leapt up into the back. The gunman hauled his partner back into the truck with him, and the driver gunned the engine. The truck threw out some turf before it dug in, jounced back onto the street, and whipped away into traffic. I stared after it for a second, panting. I lowered the shotgun, realizing as I did that I had somehow managed to keep hold of the toad I had picked up in my left hand. It wriggled and struggled in a fashion that suggested I had been close to crushing it, and I tried to ease up on my grip without losing it. I turned to look for Billy. The wolf paced back over to his discarded sweatpants, shimmered for a second, and became once more the naked young man. There were two long cuts on his face, parallel with his jaw. Blood ran down over his throat in a fine sheet. He carried himself tensely, but it was the only indication he gave of the pain. "You all right?" I asked him. He nodded and jerked on his pants and shirt. "Yeah, what the hell was that?" "Ghoul," I told him. "Probably one of the LaChase clan. They're working with the Red Court and they don't much like me."
"Why don't they like you?"
"I've given them headaches a few times." Billy lifted a corner of his shirt to hold against the cuts on his face. "I didn't expect the claws. They're sneaky that way."
"Ghoul, huh? Is it dead?"
I shook my head. "They're like cockroaches. They recover from just about anything. Can you walk?"
"Yeah."
"Good. Let's get out of here." We headed toward the beetle. I picked up the cloth sack of toads on the way and started shaking them back out onto the ground. I put the toad I'd nearly squished down with them, then wiped my hand off on the grass. Billy squinted at me.
"Why are you letting them go?"
"Because they're real."
"How do you know?"
"The one I was holding crapped in my hand." I let Billy into the blue beetle and got in the other side. I fetched the first aid kit from under my seat and passed it over to him. Billy pressed a cloth against his face, looking out at the toads.
"So that means things are in a bad way."
"Yeah," I confirmed. "Things are in a bad way." I was silent for a minute. Then I said, "You saved my life." He shrugged. He didn't look at me.
"So you set up the appointment for 3 o'clock, right? What was the name? Somerset?"
He glanced at me and kept a smile from his mouth, but not from his eyes.
"Yeah."
I scratched at my beard and nodded. "I've been distracted lately. Maybe I should clean up first."
"Might be good," Billy agreed.
I sighed. "I'm such an ass sometimes." Billy laughed.
"Sometimes. You're human like the rest of us."
I started up the beetle. It wheezed a little, but I coaxed it to life. Just then something hit my hood with a hard, heavy thump. Then again, another heavy blow on the roof. A feeling of dizziness swept over me, a nausea that came so suddenly and so violently that I clutched the steering wheel in a simple effort not to collapse. Distantly, I could hear Billy asking me if I was all right. I wasn't. Power moved and stirred in the air outside. Hectic disruption. The forces of magic, usually moving in smooth and quiet patterns, suddenly cast into tumult, disruptive, maddening chaos. I tried to push the sensations away from me and labored to open my eyes. Toads were raining down, not occasionally plopping, but raining down, so thick and hard that they darkened the sky. No gentle laundry chute drop for these poor things, either. They fell like hailstones, splattering on the concrete, on the hood of the Beetle. One of them fell hard enough to send a spiderweb of cracks through my windshield, and I dropped into gear and scooted down the street. After a few hundred yards, we got away from the otherworldly rain. Both of us were breathing too fast. Billy had been right. The rain of toads meant something serious was going on. The White Council was coming to town tonight to discuss the war. I had a client to meet, and the vampires had evidently upped the stakes, no pun intended, striking at me more openly than they had dared to before. I flipped on the windshield wipers. Amphibian blood left scarlet streaks on the cracked glass. "Good Lord," Billy breathed. "Yeah," I said. "It never rains. It pours."
Chapter 2. I dropped Billy off at his apartment near campus. I didn't think the ghoul would be filing a police report, but I wiped down the shotgun anyway. Billy wrapped it in a towel I had in the back seat of the Beetle and took it with him, promising to dispose of the weapon. His girlfriend Georgia, a willowy girl, a foot taller than him, waited on the apartment's balcony in dark shorts and a scarlet bikini top, displaying a generous amount of impressively sun-bronzed skin in a manner far more confident and appealing than I would have guessed from her a year before. My, how the kids have grown. The moment Billy got out of the car, Georgia looked up sharply from her book and her nostrils flared. She headed into the house and met him at the door with a first aid kit. She glanced at the car, her expression worried, and nodded to me. I waved back, trying to look friendly. From Georgia's expression, I hadn't managed better than surly. They went into the apartment, and I pulled away before anyone could come out to socialize with me. After a minute, I pulled over, killed the engine, and squinted up at myself in the rearview mirror of the Beetle. It came as a shock to me. I know, that sounds stupid, but I don't keep mirrors in my home. Too many things can use mirrors, as windows, even doors, and it was a risk I preferred to skip entirely. I hadn't glanced in a mirror in weeks. I looked like a wrecked train. More so than usual, I mean. My features are usually kind of long, lean, all sharp angles. I've got almost black hair to go with my dark eyes. Now I had gray and purplish circles under them, deep ones. The lines of my face, where they weren't covered by several months of untrimmed beard, looked as sharp as the edges of a business card. My hair had grown out long and shaggy, not in that sexy young rock star kind of way, but in that time-to-take-Rover-to-the-groomer kind of way. It didn't even have the advantage of being symmetrical, since a big chunk had been burned short in one spot when a small incendiary had been smuggled to me in a pizza delivery box, back when I could still afford to order pizza. My skin was pale, pasty even. I looked like death warmed over, provided someone had made death run the Boston Marathon. I looked tired, burned out, used up. I sat back in my seat. I hate it when I'm wrong. But it looked like maybe Billy and the werewolves, Stars and Stones, it sounded like a bad rock band, had a point. I tried to think of the last time I'd gotten a haircut, a shave. I'd had a shower last week, hadn't I? I mopped at my face with my shaking hands. The days and nights have been blurring lately. I spent my time in the lab under my apartment, researching 24/7. The lab was in the sub-basement, all damp stone and no windows. Circadian rhythms, bah, I pretty much dispensed with day and night. There was too much to think about to pay attention to such trivial details. About 9 months before, I'd gotten my girlfriend nearly killed. Maybe more than killed. Susan Rodriguez had been a reporter for a yellow journal called the Midwestern Arcane when we met. She was one of the few people around who were willing to accept the idea of the supernatural as a factual reality. She'd clawed for every detail, every story, every ounce of proof she could dig up so that she could try to raise public consciousness on the matter. To that end, she'd followed me to a vampire shindig, and the monsters got her. Billy had been right about that, too.
The vampires, the Red Court, had changed her. Or maybe it would be more accurate to say that they infected her. Though she was still human, technically, she'd been given their macabre thirst. If she ever sated it, she would turn all the way into one of them. Some part of her would die, and she would be one of the monsters, body and soul. That's why the research. I'd been looking for some way to help her, to create a vaccine, or to purge her body, something, anything. I'd asked her to marry me. She told me no, and she left town. I read her syndicated column in the Arcane. She must have been mailing them in to her editor, so at least I knew she was alive. She'd asked me not to follow her, and I hadn't. I wouldn't, until I could figure out a way to get her out of the mess I'd gotten her into. There had to be something I could do. Had to be. There had to be. I bowed my head, suddenly grimacing so hard that the muscles of my face cramped, ached, and smoldered. My chest felt tight, and my body seemed to burn with useless, impotent flame. I'm a wizard. I should have been able to protect Susan. Should have been able to save her. Should have been able to help her. Should have been smarter. Should have been faster. Should have been better. Should have told her you loved her before it was too late. Right, Harry? I tried not to cry. I willed myself not to, with all of my years of training and experience and self-discipline. It would accomplish nothing. It wouldn't put me anywhere closer to finding a cure for Susan. I was so damn tired. I left my face in my hands. I didn't want someone walking by to see me bawling. It took a long time to get myself back under control. I'm not sure how long it was, but the shadows had changed, and I was baking in the car, even with the windows down. It occurred to me that it was stupid to be sitting here on the street for more vampire thugs to come find, plain as day. I was tired and dirty and hungry, but I didn't have the cash to get anything to eat, and by the sun I didn't have time to go back to the apartment for soup. Not if I was to keep my appointment with Miss Somerset. And I needed that appointment. Billy had been right about that, too. If I didn't start earning my keep again, I'd lose the office and the apartment. I wouldn't get much magical research done from a cardboard box in the alley. Time to get moving, then. I raked my fingers uselessly through my mop of hair and headed for my office. A passing clock told me I was already a couple of minutes late for the appointment. Between that and my appearance, boy, I was going to wow the client. This day just kept getting better. My office is in a building in Midtown. It isn't much of a building, but it still looked too good for me that day. I got a glare from the aging security guard downstairs and felt lucky that he recognized me from the previous encounters. A new guy probably would have given me the bums rush without blinking. I nodded at the guy and smiled and tried to look businesslike. I walked past the elevator on my way to the stairs. There was a sign on it that said it was under repair. The elevator hadn't been quite the same since a giant scorpion had torn into one of the cars, and someone had thrown the elevator up to the top of its chute with a torrent of wind in order to smash the big bug against the roof. The resulting fall sent the car plummeting all the way back to the ground floor and wreaked havoc with the building in general, raising everyone's rents. Or that's what I heard, anyway. Don't look at me like that. Could have been someone else. Okay, maybe not the orthodontist on 4, or the psychiatrist on 6. Probably not the insurance office on 7, or the accountant on 9 either. Maybe not the lawyers on the top floor. Maybe. But it isn't always me when something goes catastrophically wrong. Anyway, no one can prove anything. I opened the door to the stairwell and headed up the stairs to my office on the 5th floor. I went down the hall, past a quiet buzz of the consulting firm that took up most of the space on the floor, to my office. The lettering on the frosted glass read, "Harry Dresden, Wizard." I reached out to open the door. A spark jumped to my finger when my hand got within an inch or three of the doorknob, popping against my skin with a sharp little snap of discomfort. I paused. Even with the building's AC laboring and wheezing, it wasn't that cool and dry. call me paranoid, but there's nothing like a murder attempt in broad daylight to make a man cautious. I focused on my bracelet again, drawing on my apprehension to ready a shield should I need it. With the other hand, I pushed open the door to my office. My office is usually pretty tidy, or in any case, I didn't remember it being quite as sloppy as it looked now. Given how little I'd been there lately, it seemed unfair that it should have gotten quite that bad. The table by the door, where I kept a bunch of flyers with titles like Magic for Dummies and I'm a Wizard, Ask Me How, sat crookedly against the wall. The flyers were scattered carelessly over its surface and onto the floor. I could smell the faintest stink of long-burnt coffee. I must have left it on. Oops. My desk had a similar fungus coating of loose papers, and several drawers on my filing cabinet stood open, with files stacked on top of the cabinets or thrust sideways into their places so they stood up out of their drawers. My ceiling fan whirled woozily, clicking on every rotation. Someone had evidently tried to straighten things up. My mail sat neatly stacked in three different piles. Both metal trash cans were suspiciously empty, Billy and company then. In the ruins of my office stood a woman with the kind of beauty that makes men murder friends and start wars. She stood by my desk with her arms folded, facing the door, hips cocked to one side, her expression skeptical. She had white hair. Not white blonde, not platinum. White as snow. White as the finest marble. Bound up like a captured cloud to bear the lines of her slender throat. I don't know how her skin managed to look pale beside that hair, but it did. Her lips were the color of frozen mulberries, almost shocking in a smooth and lovely face, and her oblique eyes were a deep green that tinted to blue when she tilted her head and looked me over. She wasn't old, wasn't young, wasn't anything but stunning. I tried to keep my jaw from hitting the floor and forced my brain to start doing something by taking stock of her wardrobe. She wore a woman's suit of charcoal gray, the cut immaculate. The skirt showed exactly enough leg to make it hard not to look, and her dark pumps had heels just high enough to give you ideas. She wore a bone-white V-neck beneath her jacket, the neckline dipping just low enough to make me want to be watching if she took a deep breath. Opals sat in silver flashed on her ears, at her throat, glittering through an array of colors I wouldn't have expected from opals. Too many scarlets and violets and deep blues. Her nails had somehow been lacquered in the same opalescence. I caught the scent of her perfume, something wild and rich, heavy and sweet, like orchids. My heart sped up, and the testosterone-oriented part of my brain wished that I'd been able to bathe, or shave, or at least that I hadn't worn sweatpants. Her mouth quirked into a smile, and she arced one pale brow, saying nothing, letting me gawk. One thing was certain. No woman like that would have anything less than money. Lots of money. Money I could use to pay the rent, buy groceries, maybe even splurge a little and get a wheelbarrow to help with the cleaning of my apartment. I only hesitated for a heartbeat, wondering if it was proper for a full-fledged wizard of the White Council to be that interested in cash. I made up my mind fast. Phenomenal cosmic powers be damned. I have a lease. Miss Somerset, I presume, I managed finally. No one could do suave like me. If I was careful, I should be able to trip over something and complete the image. I'm Harry Dresden.
I believe you are late, she replied.
Somerset had a voice like her outfit, rich, suggestive, cultured. Her English had an accent I couldn't place, maybe European, definitely interesting.
Your assistant informed me when to arrive. I don't like to be kept waiting. So I let myself in.
She glanced at my desk, then back at me.
I almost wish I hadn't.
Yeah, I didn't hear you were coming until, I looked around at my office dismayed and shut the door behind me. I know this looks pretty unprofessional.
Quite correct.
I moved to one of the chairs I keep for clients facing my desk and hurriedly cleared it off.
Please sit down. Would you like a cup of coffee or anything?
Sounds less than sanitary. Why should I take the risk? She sat, her back straight on the edge of the chair, following me with her eyes as I walked around the desk. They were a cool, noticeable weight on me as I moved, and I sat down at my desk, frowning.
Are you the kind who takes chances?
I like to hedge my bets, she murmured. You, for example, Mr. Dresden. I have come here today to decide whether or not I should gamble a great deal upon your abilities. She paused and then added, Thus far, you have made less than a sterling impression. I rested my elbows on my desk and steepled my fingers.
Yeah, I know that all this makes me look like
a desperate man, she suggested. Someone who is clearly obsessed with other matters. She nodded toward the stacks of envelopes on my desk.
One who is shortly to lose his place of business if he does not pay his debts.
I think you need the work, she began to rise.
And if you lack the ability to take care of such minor matters, I doubt if you will be any use to me.
Wait, I said, rising. Please, at least let me hear you out. If it turns out that I think I can help you...
She lifted her chin and interrupted me effortlessly.
But that isn't the question, is it? She asked. The question is whether or not I think you can help me.
You have shown me nothing to make me think that you could.
She paused, sitting back down again.
And yet...
I sat back down across from her.
Yet? I have heard things, Mr. Dresden, about people with your abilities, about the ability to look into their eyes.
I tilted my head.
I wouldn't call it an ability. It just happens.
Yet you are able to see within them. You call it the soul gaze, do you not?
I nodded warily and started adding together lots of small bits and pieces.
Yes. Revealing their true nature. Seeing the truth about someone upon whom you look.
And they see me. Yes.
She smiled, cool and lovely.
Then let us look upon one another, Mr. Dresden, you and I. Then we will know if you can be of any use to me.
Surely it will cost me nothing.
I wouldn't be so sure. It's the sort of thing that stays with you, like an appendectomy scar or baldness. When you look on someone's soul, you don't forget it, not ever. I didn't like the direction this was going. I don't think it would be a good idea.
But why not? She pressed. It won't take long, will it, Mr. Dresden?
That's really not the issue. Her mouth firmed into a line.
I see. Then if you will excuse me.
This time I interrupted her. Miss Somerset, I think you may have made a mistake in your estimations.
Her eyes glittered, anger showing for a moment, cool and far away.
Oh?
I nodded. I opened the drawer to my desk and took out a pad of paper.
Yeah. I've had a rough time of things lately.
You couldn't possibly know how little that matters to me.
I drew out a pen, took off the lid, and set it down beside the pad.
Uh-huh. Then you came in here, rich, gorgeous, kind of too good to be true.
And? She inquired.
Too good to be true, I repeated. I drew out the .44 caliber revolver from the desk drawer, leveled it at her, and thumbed back the hammer.
Call me crazy, but lately I've been thinking that if something's too good to be true, then it probably isn't.
Put your hands on the desk, please. Her eyebrows arched. Those gorgeous eyes widened enough to show the whites all the way around them. She moved her hands, swallowing as she did, and laid her palms on the desk.
What do you think you're doing? She demanded.
I'm testing a theory, I said.
I kept the gun and my eyes on her and opened another drawer.
See, lately, I've been getting nasty visitors, so it's made me do some thinking about what kind of trouble to expect, and I think I've got you pegged.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Dresden, but I am certain.
Save it.
I rummaged in a drawer and found what I needed. A moment later, I lifted a plain old nail of simple metal out of the drawer and put it on the desk.
What's that?
She all but whispered.
Litmus test, I said. Then I flicked the nail gently with one finger and sent it rolling across the surface of my desk and toward her perfectly manicured nails. She didn't move until a split second before the nail touched her, but then she did, a blur of motion that took her two long strides back from my desk and knocked over the chair she'd been sitting on. The nail rolled off the edge of the desk and fell to the floor with a clink. Iron, I said. Cold iron. Fairies don't like it. Her expression drained from her face. One moment there had been arrogant conceit, haughty superiority, blithe confidence. But that simply vanished, leaving her features cold and lovely and remote and empty of all emotion, of anything recognizably human. The bargain with my godmother has months yet to go, I said. A year and a day, she had to leave me alone. That was a deal. And if she's trying to weasel out of it, I'm going to be upset. She regarded me in that empty silence for long moments more. It was unsettling to see a face so lovely look so wholly alien, as though something lurked behind those features that had little in common with me and did not care to make the effort to understand. That blank mask made my throat tighten, and I had to work not to let the gun in my hand shake. But then she did something that made her look even more alien, more frightening. She smiled. A slow smile, cruel as a barbed knife. When she spoke, her voice sounded just as beautiful as it had before, but it was empty, quiet, haunting. She spoke, and it made me want to lean closer to her, to hear her more clearly. Clever, she murmured. Yes. Not too distracted to think. Just what I need. A cold shiver danced down my spine. I don't want any trouble, I said. Just go, and we can both pretend nothing happened. But it has, she murmured. Just the sound of her voice made the room feel colder. You have seen through this veil, proven your worth. How did you do it?
Static on the doorknob, I said. It should have been locked. You shouldn't have been able to get in here, so you must have gone through it. And you danced around my questions rather than simply answering them.
Still smiling, she nodded. Go on.
You don't have a purse? Not many women go out in a $3,000 suit and no purse.
Hmm, she said. Yes. You will do perfectly, Mr. Dresden.
I don't know what you're talking about, I said. I'm having nothing more to do with fairies.
I don't like being called that, Mr. Dresden.
You'll get over it. Get out of my office.
You should know, Mr. Dresden, that my kind, from great to small, are bound to speak the truth.
That hasn't slowed your ability to deceive. Her eyes glittered, and I saw her pupils change, slipping from round mortal orbs to slow feline lengths. Cat-eyed, she regarded me, unblinking.
Yet I have spoken. I plan to gamble, and I will gamble upon you.
What?
I require your service. Something precious has been stolen. I wish you to recover it.
Let me get this straight, I said. You want me to recover stolen goods for you?
Not for me, she murmured, but for the rightful owners. I wish you to discover and catch the thief and to vindicate me.
Do it yourself, I said.
In this matter, I cannot act wholly alone, she murmured. That is why I have chosen you to be my emissary, my agent.
I laughed at her. That made something else come into those perfect pale features, anger. Anger, cold and terrible, flashed in her eyes and all but froze the laugh in my throat. I don't think so, I said. I'm not making any more bargains with your folk. I don't even know who you are.
Dear child, she murmured. A slow edge to her voice. The bargain has already been made. You gave your life, your fortune, your future, in exchange for power.
Yeah, with my godmother, and that's still being contested.
No longer, she said. Even in this world of mortals, the concept of debt passes from one hand to the next. Selling mortgages
Yes? My belly went cold. What are you saying? Her teeth showed, sharp and white. It wasn't a smile. Your mortgage, mortal child, has been sold. I have purchased it. You are mine, and you will assist me in this matter. I set the gun down on my desk and opened the top drawer. I took out my letter opener, one of the standard machine jobs with a heavy flat blade and a screw grip handle. You're wrong, I said, and the denial in my voice sounded patently obvious, even to me. My godmother would never do that. For all I know, you're trying to trick me. She smiled, watching me, her eyes bright.
Then by all means, let me reassure you of the truth.
My left palm slammed down onto the table. I watched, startled, as I gripped the letter opener in my right hand, slasher movie style. In a panic, I tried to hold back my hand to drop the opener, but my arms were running on automatic, like they were someone else's. Wait! I shouted. She regarded me, cold and distant and interested. I slammed the letter opener down onto the back of my own hand, hard. My desk is a cheap one. The steel bit cleanly through the meat between my thumb and forefinger and sank into the desk, pinning me there. Pain washed up my arm even as blood started oozing out of the wound. I tried to fight it down, but I was panicked and in no condition to exert a lot of control. A whimper slipped out of me, and I tried to pull the steel away to get it out of my hand, but my arm simply twisted, wrenching the letter opener counterclockwise. The pain flattened me. I wasn't even able to get enough breath to scream. The woman, the fairy, reached down and took my fingers away from the letter opener. She withdrew it with a sharp, decisive gesture and laid it flat on the desk, my blood gleaming all over it.
Wizard, you know as well as I, were you not bound to me, I would have no such power over you.
At that moment, most of what I knew was that my hand hurt, but some dim part of me realized she was telling the truth. Fairies don't just get to ride in and play puppet master. You have to let them in. I'd let my godmother, Leia, in years before when I was younger, dumber. I'd given her the slip last year, forced an abeyance of her claim that should have protected me for a year and a day. But now she'd passed the reins on to someone else, someone who hadn't been in on the second bargain. I looked up at her, pain and sudden anger making my voice into a low, harsh growl.
Who are you?
The woman ran an opalescent fingernail through the blood on my desk. She lifted it to her lips and idly touched it to her tongue. She smiled, slower, more sensual, and every bit as alien.
I have many names, she murmured, but you may call me Mab, Queen of Air and Darkness, Monarch of the Winter Court of the Shi.
Chapter 3. The bottom fell out of my stomach. A fairy queen. A fairy queen was standing in my office. I was looking at a fairy queen, talking to a fairy queen. And she had me by the short hairs. Boy, I thought my life was on the critical list already. Fear can literally feel like ice water. It can be a cold feeling that you swallow, that rolls down your throat and spreads into your chest. It steals your breath and makes your heart labor when it shouldn't, before expanding into your belly and hips, leaving quivers behind. And then it heads for the thighs, the knees, occasionally with an embarrassing stop on the way, stealing the strength from the long muscles that think you should be using them to run the hell away. I swallowed a mouthful of fear, my eyes on the poisonously lovely fairy standing on the other side of my desk. It made Mab smile.
Yes, she murmured. Wise enough to be afraid. To understand, at least in part. How does it feel? To know what you know, child.
My voice came out unsteady and more quiet than I would have liked.
Sort of like Tokyo when Godzilla comes up on the beach.
Mab tilted her head, watching me with that same smile. Maybe she didn't get the reference, or maybe she didn't like being compared to a 30-story lizard. Or maybe she did like it. I mean, how should I know? I have enough trouble figuring out human women. I didn't meet Mab's eyes. I wasn't worried about a soul gaze any longer. Both parties had to have a soul for that to happen. But plenty of things can get to you if you make eye contact too long. It carries all sorts of emotions and metaphors. I stared at Mab's chin, my hand burning with pain, and said nothing, because I was afraid. I hate being afraid. I hate it more than anything in the whole world. I hate being made to feel useless. I hate being made to feel helpless. I hate being bullied, too. And Mab might as well have been ramming her fist down my throat and demanding my lunch money. The fairy queens were bad news. Big bad news. Short of calling up some hoary old god or squaring off against the White Council itself, I wasn't likely to run into anything else with as much raw power as Mab. I could have thrown a magical sucker punch at her, could have tried to take her out. But even if we'd been on even footing, I doubt I would have ruffled her hair. She had a bond on me, a magical conduit. She could send just about anything right past my defenses, and there wouldn't be anything I could do about it. Bullies make me mad. And I've been known to do some foolish things when I'm angry. Forget it, I said, my voice hot. No deal. Get it over and blast me. Lock the door on your way out. My response didn't seem to ruffle her. She folded her arms and murmured, such anger, such fire. Yes.
I watched you stalemate your godmother, the Leonshi, autumn last. Few mortals have ever done as much. Bold, impertinent. I admire that kind of strength, wizard. I need that kind of strength.
I fumbled around on my desk until I found a tissue dispenser and started packing the wound with the flimsy fabric.
I don't really care what you need, I told her. I'm not going to be your emissary or anything else unless you want to force me. And I doubt I'd be much good to you then. So do whatever you're going to do and get out of my office.
You should care, Mr. Dresden, Mab told me. It concerns you explicitly. I purchased your debt in order to make you an offer. To give you the chance to win free of your obligations.
Yeah, right. Save it. I'm not interested.
You may serve, wizard, or you may be served. As a meal. Do you not wish to be free?
I looked up at her, warily, visions of barbecued me on a table with an apple in my mouth dancing in my head.
What do you mean by free?
Free, she said, wrapping those frozen berry lips around the word so that I couldn't help but notice. Free of the she influence, of the bonds of your obligation, first to the Leonshi, and now to me.
The whole thing a wash. We go our separate ways?
Precisely.
I looked down at my hurting hand and scowled.
I don't think you were much into freedom as a concept, Mab.
You should not presume, wizard. I adore freedom. Anyone who doesn't have it wants it.
I took a deep breath and tried to get my heart rate under control. I couldn't let either fear or anger do my thinking for me. My instincts screamed for me to go for the gun again and give it a shot, but I had to think. It was the only thing that could get you clear of the Fae.
Mab was on the level about her offer. I could feel that,
sense it in a way so primal, so visceral, that there was no room left for doubt. She could cut me loose if I agreed to her bargain. Of course, her price might be too high. She hadn't gotten to that yet. And the Fae have a way of making sure that further bargains only get you in deeper instead of getting you clear. Just like credit card companies or student loan people. Now, there's evil for you. I could feel Mab watching me, Sylvester to my Tweety bird. That thought kind of cheered me up, generally speaking. Tweety kicks Sylvester's ass in the end.
Okay, I told her. I'm listening.
Three tasks, Mab murmured, holding up three fingers by way of visual aid. From time to time, I will make a request of you. When you have fulfilled three requests, your obligation to me ceases.
Silence lay in the room for a moment, and I blinked.
What?
That's it?
Mab nodded. Any three tasks, any three requests.
Mab nodded. Just as simple as that? I mean, you say it like that, and I could pass you the salt 3 times, and that would be that.
Her eyes, green-blue like glacial ice, remained on my face, unblinking.
Do you accept?
I rubbed at my mouth slowly, mulling it over in my head. It was a simple bargain, as these things went. They could get really complicated with contracts and everything. Mab had offered me a great package. Sweet, neat, and tidy as a Halloween candy. Which meant I'd be an idiot not to check for razor blades and cyanide.
I decide which requests I fulfill and which I don't?
Even so.
And if I refuse a request, there'll be no reprisals or punishments from you?
She tilted her head and blinked her eyes slowly.
Agreed. You, not I, will choose which requests you fulfill.
There was one landmine I'd found, at least. And no more selling my mortgage, either? Or whistling up the lackeys to chastise or harass me by proxy? This remains between the two of us?
She laughed, and it sounded as merry, clear, and lovely as bells, if someone pressed them against my teeth while they were still ringing.
As your godmother did. Fool me twice. Shame on me, wizard.
Agreed. I licked my lips, thinking hard. Had I left her any openings? Could she get to me any other way?
Well, wizard, Mab asked, have we a bargain?
I gave myself a second to wish I'd been less tired or less in pain. The events of the day and the impending council meeting this evening hadn't exactly left my head in world-class negotiating condition, but I knew one thing for certain. If I didn't get out from under Mab's bond, I would be dead, or worse than dead, in short order. Better to act and be mistaken than not to act and get casually crushed.
All right, I said. We have a bargain.
When I said the words, a little frisson prickled over the nape of my neck and down the length of my spine. My wounded hand twitched in an aching, painful pang. Mab closed her eyes, smiling a feline smile with those dark lips, and inclined her head.
Good. Yes.
You know that look on Wile E. Coyote's face when he runs at full steam off the cliff and then realizes what he's done? He doesn't look down, but he feels around with one toe, and right then, right before he falls, his face becomes drawn with a primal dread.
That's what I must have looked like. I know it was pretty much like what I felt, but there was no help for it. Maybe if I didn't stop to check for the ground underneath my feet, I'd keep going indefinitely. I looked away from Mab and tried to tend to my hand as best I could. It still throbbed, and disinfecting the wound was going to hurt a lot more. I doubt it would need sutures. A small blessing, I guess. A manila envelope hit my desk. I looked up to see Mab drawing a pair of gloves onto her hands.
"What's this?"
I asked.
"My request," she replied. "Within are the details of a man's death. I wish you to vindicate me of it by discovering the identity of his killer and returning what was stolen from him."
I opened the envelope. Inside was a 8x10 glossy black and white of a body. An old man lay at the bottom of a flight of stairs, his neck at a sharp angle to his shoulders. He had frizzy white hair and a tweed jacket. Accompanying the picture was an article from the Tribune, headlined, "Local Artist Dies in Midnight Accident."
"Ronald Rule," I said, glancing over the article. "I've heard of him. He has a studio in Bucktown, I think."
Mab nodded.
"Hailed as a visionary of the American artistic culture, though I assume they use the term lightly. Creator of worlds of imagination," it says.
I guess now that he's dead, they'll say all kinds of nice things.
I read over the rest of the article. "The police call it an accident."
"It was not," Mab responded.
I looked up at her.
"How do you know?"
She smiled.
"And why should you care?" I asked. "It isn't like the cops are after you."
"There are powers of judgment other than mortal law. It is enough for you to know I wish to see justice done," she said. "Simply that."
"Uh-huh," I said, frowning. "You said something was stolen from him?"
"What?"
"You will know it."
I put the picture back in the envelope and left it on my desk.
"I'll think about it,"
Mab assured me.
"You will accept this request, Wizard Dresden."
I scowled at her and set my jaw. I said, I'll think about it. Mab's cat eyes glittered, and I saw a few white, white teeth in her smile. She took a pair of dark sunglasses from the pocket of her jacket.
Is it not polite to show a client to the door?
I glared.